Following program is brought to you by Living Ministries Media.
To samen en we zullen het allemaal in gebed tot het begin gaan. You don't have the idea, you can just do this, you can have this or have that, and you can fight. And so, begin to think of complaints in terms of possessions or in terms of accomplishment. And so, when you get the notion you can just do that or just accomplish that, you'd be complete. Well, I did all the things when I was young, games and so forth, trampolines. The thing that I found would try to make complete was when I saw a young lady in school, and I thought, man, if I could just get her, I would be complete. And if you found some fun that way. And so I decided to go for her, and to my fortune, I got her. And so I remember walking across the ball fields or the schoolyards with her arms, with my chest sticking out to go. And I remember the fellas looking at me with envy, grinning at me. And I just said to myself, "Be giving your heart out, please." But you know, it wasn't long before she found somebody else that could make her more complete than me. And then I was not thinking either of her compliments. The worst thing about it was that there was a song that became popular during the summertime. School was ending, and she went off with somebody else, and school ended. And then the popular song that hit the charts was Sealed with a Kiss. Any of you remember that song at all? Yes, it's going to be a cool, holy summer. Those were the words. And so I remember the time I listened to that song, I just started crying along because, you know, my girl thought it might be. Well, that basically caused me to become pretty hard. I don't want to be hurt anymore, so I make sure that I'm hurt rather than being hurt. That's what I'm saying. But I wanted to get to a place where I could do something, achieve something, so I can feel good about myself. And so I began to form a group that would go out and dive into my life. But it wasn't long before that group began to show popularity in New York City. We were 12 years old. And I remember how excited I was because the manager that we got said, "We went to the Bronx." I'd never been outside of Brooklyn. If something about the Bronx was something great. And so he took us to the Bronx. And he took us to a store and wants to get us tailor-made suits. And for the first time in my life, to have a tailor-made suit was wow. And it was a short-skin suit. Any of you remember the short-skin suits? Any of you? Do we have any dinosaurs among us? Okay. And so, it was actually short-skin, but it had a black velvet collar. And so, I remember the people looming out as we came back to the neighborhood. They saw us with our shirts and suits. And we put a new car that they bought for us, and with our name painted on the sign. And so, man, I felt complete. That's what I'm saying. We felt that we finally made it. But as we got deeper into show business, unfortunately, drugs became part of the scene. And Donnie, who had a voice that was gorgeous, was found inside this home overdose with drugs. He was dead. And Cheryl was, because he had such a voice that even Count Basie, if any of you remember Count Basie, had invited him to join his band. But Donnie and me were so close that he chose not to go. Sad to say, he was gone. Don't know what to do, we just continued on. And so we formed a group called the Vampires. And we actually tried to do everything we could to look vampire-ish. There's even a spray paint that you can get. It was a hairspray that was white. And you can actually spray on your white and then put it in to make it look like Pastor Hoskin. And so the sides were white, you know. But we could have a biker hair, we do. Okay. So we did the
precepts from Sir Arthur came from, whose friend Sir Arthur. And Tommy and myself, then we had brothers turn out to be religious. My family was three. And a book of agent, we had a book of agent, we had an assistant manager and a full-time manager. We also wanted to become recording artists because if you become a recording artist, you became a big star. So we recorded at least two records, I recall. And upstairs, of course, recording students, what we call an H-Frank recording studio. And we thought that was a state of the art to the H-Rest of life. But we were recording right in a studio above what it used to be called the Ed Sullivan Show. I don't know if you ever heard of the Ed Sullivan Show. And so we used to see Barbara Streisand and other people hanging around there. And so we really were feeling good about ourselves. We had actually gotten a contract for recording. We had actually gotten managers. We had nice cars to drive around in. And body grounds. We had gold grounds that we were going to wear the hats when we performed. And so now we had gay golden girls, we had the band, and we were trying quite a bit in performing in different places. But I began to feel that the manager was taking advantage of us. He was a borough president of the five boroughs in New York City, and he happened to be one of the borough presidents. But he was only taking 20%, the booking agent was taking 20%, and the assistant manager was taking 10%. So we were losing 50% of our income. And so, by the way, I thought when I came to that lecture, I said, oh, no, don't ask them to lose 10%. I thought that was a pretty good deal. So, here I was in this situation, feeling like we were being taken. And so, I encouraged the band members to do a coup d'etat. And so, we ousted the manager. Because he was doing us a service. He was at least giving us nightclubs to perform, etc. And so I didn't realize how long it was done. We got the manager out of our lives that we took the equipment with him. I forgot the equipment belonged to him. So then we moved out of the equipment. And this time we were performing in a particular nightclub that was called the Golden Nugget, which we did pretty famous there. And which, because of our music, they were knocking out walls and extending the dance floor, building more and more. So we told the club owner we couldn't perform any longer. He was shocked because he loved us and we had kind of become like family. And he said, what's wrong? I said, well, we're going to have our manager and each of our appointment. And he said, I'll take care of it. Come back next day. So we went the next day over to see him. And he drove us over to what they call a bookie joint. You know those terms? This is a place where the mafia was. We didn't know that, but when we were in there, we saw pictures of Frank Sinatra from all the people that they were sponsoring. And so all of a sudden, it began to dawn on me that we were hitting the jackpot. We were not being placed in contact with the same people that were promoting and sponsoring these famous people. Yes, a man came to us, his name was Nicky, with a big cigar sticking out of his mouth, wagging it around. He said, I understand, boys, you have a little problem. And we said, yeah, we will fix it for you, boys. Just come back tomorrow, we'll take good care of you. So we showed up there today, and took us to a music store in the family, which is called St. Ash. I don't know if it's still there or not. But he was the place to buy instruments. We went in there and he said, boys, whatever you want, go get it. So we went in there and we went wild because he told us we could get anything that we wanted to. So we bought our amplifiers, we bought our guitars, we bought everything. And he came in and said to us, you sure you got everything, boys? The only thing more knowledge that we had, the mic stands, we had the microphones, we had the amp chambers, we had the reverb chambers, we had the boxes, we had everything. So he pulled out a lot of money. I've never seen that much money.
after the fact on his part. And then he said, by the way, boys, you have a sign of a piece of paper, you understand. So we signed a piece of paper, but he was stupid enough, he was asking only for 10%. To pay back to the opponent. And also, he was doing a favor for his buddy who also was part of the mafia. So now we are sponsored by the mafia. We thought, this is great. We really have the opportunity now to go on who we want to. By association, along with all of these connections, along with all of these things, came other lifestyle issues that were not conducive to our material. They began to share things with us, their secrets and all that. And I remember that all those brothers who were all using gangs and so forth, they always used to talk in front of us and they would laugh. They'd say, oh, it's lucky. You know, that woman didn't get to the mafia. Because once you get in, you can't get out. And I remember that, and yet it didn't seem like it was okay. These guys were as bad as I thought they were. Now, usually, the mafia was painted as corrupt individuals with dumb officers, with, you know, breaking legs and all that. And we did discover that they could do that. We sometimes we would hear them say, hey, but Sam, be careful, you understand, because I always, we pray for your legs. So we understood. But they always protected us. And wherever we went, we didn't have to worry about the thing. However, there was too much available to us. And Tony, this fellow right here, who joined us, never drank, never smoked. He was a Boy Scout director. But he loved music. It's interesting because he and I, we taught himself guitar, and he actually played a right-handed guitar with tandem. So whenever he played guitar, you know, not only would run down, and he would run up, you know, it was kind of backwards. But he was a fantastic guitar player. That kid could just play anything. You know, just ask him to work, he could do this, he could do it. We all got very proficient in our performance. And I was in the choir master, and I was the one who organized the staff, etc. It was the one who organized the harmony, and I took care of the equipment. And so we really began to settle down. In fact, one time, this is us performing in that nightclub called the Mecca. I'm here, and Manny and Tony, of course, has bought a two-neck guitar, Felspring 6-3. And the amplifiers, of course, you can see how big the amplifiers are, and that's why we're getting a little difficult to having a little difficulty here, as well as I used to in the staff. When you have amplifiers that close, as you see how close they are, and there are two 25-inch speakers in the pressure and bass amplifier, we have to really produce the sound. And when you have 3,000 people in the audience, you have to really push the sound. Anyway, things continued to increase, and the morality, verbal news, and everything came with that. Here I am doing the split. I got to the place where I could play the bass guitar more than that. I'm doing solo, I was doing split, and the split is right. And so I could walk and split, but I was playing the bass solo. We all did trips with our instruments. We played with our teeth. Tony used to take his guitar and walk in with his tongue. So we did all sorts of interesting things. We discovered this, if you want to get attention, do something stupid. And so that's what we're doing. And dressed like Ben Bosch, you know, with teeth and everything. Our vehicle was a funeral hearse. We had mats on everywhere. And so everything was Ben Bosch. But I don't know if you can see the band right there on that piece of guitar. You can see that a little bit. And so we were all about the South. It was all about the South. And all this time we were climbing. It doesn't matter how high I climb, there's always something nagging. tells me something's missing. Well, at this time, my gosh, Daisy will mention what happened with her chaplain. This time, I had some same issues. Because my buddies were Jewish, took me to the synagogue just to show me how to get drunk for free. The altar boy who lived next door to us was Catholic, and I thought these guys were straight. The preachers had come to take my friends to his apartment, and as they were built, I was the one talking about. And so, I got to the place where I really became cynical against religion, cynical against anybody who talked about the Lord. And I began to despise people who were religious. I concluded that religion was for people who are old or ugly. If you're old and ugly, you might as well go to church because you really couldn't make it out in the world. But that was my thought. And so when I was having these nagging feelings, especially it was during the time when people had grown old, and you were told to go to sleep immediately before the morning. And when I was by myself, I would think, why is it that I can't seem to, no matter how bad I know, no matter how much I accomplish, no matter what I do, there's still something missing. I thought that if I could just do more activities, if I could make more money, if I could have more girls. I mean, there was a time when I asked four girls for a chance, you know what I'm saying? I was going to try and have plenty of girls, they've got to take care of it. And they're all beautiful girls. I was going to have a chance, you understand what I'm saying? But it didn't matter what I had, it didn't matter what I accomplished, it didn't matter what I built, it didn't matter how much money, it didn't matter how much popularity. There always seemed to be something more to gain, something higher to try to achieve, something more to accomplish, some more excitement, something that could really, really excite you all about. And at one particular time, we were asked to do a performance for all the city officials in New York City, the mayor, the council people, and all that. And we did it at the Waldorf Astoria. I don't know how many of you have heard of the Waldorf Astoria. But it's a very, 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 what you would call upmarket, very highly expensive hotel in New York City. And so, when we did this particular performance in this place, downtown for some minutes, I remember that we had the little girls, and I remember some of the senators getting up on all the things on the dining room table, and started dancing with the little girls and all that. So now we finished, they took us upstairs to what is called the penthouse, and I remember my little girls moving around about this Latino, and I felt kind of jealous, you know, I thought that the guy was handsome. They waited an hour, and I thought, you know, who was this guy? And they kept on saying, Posse, no. Posse, no. Posse, no. Have you ever heard of Posse? I don't know. Now, so it was in there, in the midst of us. Well, I didn't care much about Posse, not because he was competing. You understand what I'm saying? But we always came across people that we did performances. I don't know if you've heard of the drifters, all the groups that perform. We had a lot of performances with a lot of acts. And sometimes I remember one time we were in our apartment, and our manager gave us a call and said, you booked tonight to go to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and do a concert with the Flamingos and some of the other groups. And so it was about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, it was about 3 or 4 hours away. And so we were supposed to get dressed, put our equipment, and get to Harrisburg, Pennsylvania. Fortunately, we had a 442. I don't know if you know what that is. An automobile, 442. We could go at least 100 something miles an hour. And so we put everything on. We had another car, and we made a dash to perform over there. On the way there, one of the cars blew us an engine because we were going about 140 miles an hour. And we got there. Set up our equipment, we did our performance, and finished our performance, put our stuff back in the car, and off we went back to home. So we were always running, always doing things. And has a certain sense of exhilaration, a certain sense of excitement that takes place when you're doing this kind of thing. But it's such an exhilaration, such an excitement that when you're then high and absolutely there's nothing, the drugs can go. Do you understand what I'm saying? We finished our performance there. And finally, I didn't want to continue with the module. The boys did. And I quit the group. When I quit the group, I was watching somebody perform at one of the nightclubs in Paris Village, New York City. And I noticed my friend pointing at me, and somebody was like, talking to him. And the fellow came to me and asked me if I was a bass player. I said, yeah. And he said, well, yeah, no, I understand you play good. I said, yeah. He said, would you like to play with the Comets? I said, go on. He said, well, are you interested? Yes or no? I said, come on, are you kidding? Because I knew the Comets were. And I understand the Comets were playing popular here in Australia. I said, well, is that true? I know that because several years ago I came to Australia and Carrie Ann, the sweet Carrie Ann, interviewed me on the television program. It was a midday show, we had you on the midday show. Yeah. I was interviewed in the Sydney Journal, as it was called, Sydney Herald, the regular newspaper there. And I was interviewed in many radio stations. And I discovered that they're very popular here. And then I met the bass player on the counterpart of Johnny O'Keefe. Many of you remember Johnny O'Keefe from his band. Well, the bass player for him actually came to listen to one of my presentations. And as we were talking, you know, sharing this my testimony, he was there present. He came up to me and said, you know what you're saying is true. Then he told me something interesting. He said, when he joined Johnny O'Keefe, he did not know how to play an instrument, he did not know anything about music, but he was a real handsome, blue eye, blonde hair, and a bloke. So they needed somebody else on the first group, which I'm okay, and I know you fit the bill. So they said, well, look, I'll play an instrument, don't worry about it. You know what they did? They took all the strings on the bass guitar and painted black lines on the bass guitar. And they said, well, all you have to do is. So that's what he did. He said, for 25 years, now, you know the rest of the story, guys. There's a lot of phonies out there. Isn't that true? Yeah. And so, well, what I'm saying is that there's a lot of stuff going on in the children's list. And, but when I heard this guy say he wanted to play with Comets, I thought he was kidding me because we knew how famous both of the Comets had become. And the first record that we recorded was Rock About the Clock, you remember that? And the next one, Shake Around the World, and See Me Around Gator, and all those things. Anyway, finally, when I was convinced that this guy was telling the truth, I auditioned. And yes, I became a bass player for the Comets. I remember joining him on the tour. He has a newspaper article of the Comets and myself. I'm here on the right hand side. And yes, Bill is really Buck Valley Show, Johnny Lane, Bill Hill, Bill Fay, and myself. But I thought, now, I can't believe it. Here I come from one place, and all of a sudden I'm playing with those popular group. At that time, Bill Haley was called the King of Rock and Roll. Until Elvis Presley, who was more good looking than Bill, took the time out. And so, Elvis Presley became the King of Rock and Roll, and which made Bill Haley the Father of Rock and Roll. And Bill hated that title because Bill did not want to be looked at as a father. He wanted to be looked at as cold. You understand what I'm saying? And so he never appreciated the title Father of Rock and Roll, and that's what he got stuck with. So we were performing. And now I thought that now that I'm performing at the Comets, surely things are better, things are cleaner. We don't have to deal with the same kind of issues that we're dealing with back with the vampires. But for the scuba, there's the same thing, the same problems, same situation. I didn't know what to do. I was quite a disillusioned by the morning. But I thought I'd stick with it simply because it was an opportunity that few people had. And how many young kids growing up on welfare all of a sudden could take it on them and place them in a position without being part of a world famous group. So, come on, have one and go on to it. And again, I felt desperately empty and was hoping that I could find that niche, that particular level. And I looked at me finally and finally say, I finally can help you. Wasn't that okay? I was then, we were then given a contract to do a concert around the world. And I was looking forward to it. When it was possible to compete with the Beatles, they all said, Brooklyn, Derogatory, Barry Cohen, their magazine about the lack of musicianship on our part, and we were looking forward to competing with them. I was looking forward to competing against Paul McCartney, Johnny Lane, who competed against Dave Brubeck, was looking forward to competing against Ringo, and so forth. But we had a vacation right at home. For the vacation, I found something strange to my brothers. One in particular had become a Seventh-day Adventist Christian. And you have to understand that I didn't know anything. I was very ignorant about religion. Since I was a Catholic, the only thing I knew was the Catholic faith, and didn't know much about that anyway. And so, when I saw my brother pray, and he was praying for me, it sort of spooked me. And at this time, I knew I was involved in Spiritism. That Jesus would say, I'm just alive. And I didn't want this guy to put a spell on me. That's what I was doing, whatever I'm playing, using my name. So I went to my mother and said, Mom, what's going on here? Oh, they all know he's religious, she said. So he comes to talk to me, he started talking about God. I have no desire to hear about God. I have no interest in religion whatsoever. And so when he said something like, it became a Seventh-day Adventist, I thought it was a name of a disease. I had never heard of Adventist. And so, I felt sorry for him since then. Well, I told him to keep it to himself. I had no interest in him, not hear about it. And my oldest brother shows up and tells me that he's going to baptize. And I'm thinking to myself, what in the world's happening to these guys? It sort of scared me because I could tell that there was something different out there, but I didn't know what it was. I went to the church. When I got to the church, I had all the other to my shoulders. I had a ring on every finger. My pants were rainbow color, hip under, no problems. My shirt was a top of a shirt, but all down to the belly button, you know, to show how much we were. And so, that's when I went to church, with my shoulders masked. And when I went into the Adventist church, I felt awful. It was strange. The folk didn't understand that there was a many parts in the midst of for the first time. And I only came in because I was spiritually trained, came in respect, because my brother and I always wanted to be baptized. And in our family, we were very, very, very close. And so, when something incredible like that was happening, well, you showed them just out of respect. And so, I was feeling very uncomfortable as I sat on the back bench, and I saw people mocking at me anyway. And so, I got out of sight so people could look someplace else. And then the program started, and it was a baptism. I remember my sister walking into the water, and when she came out by the water, she was crying. And I was thinking to myself, standing there, I was crying about nothing. You know, you get dumped in the water, you come up, criteria, the person who prepared it, who is a large camp in Puerto Rico, didn't like to sit with one guy. He was not excited enough. He always liked to travel two or three at the same time. He was very fast. He was rabbit. They call him rabbit because he knew I did not like to move around fast. And the other brother was into terrorism. He was involved in terrorism. So this boy was a terrorist. He's actually being baptized. When he comes up out of the water, he also is crying. And that troubled me. I've never seen him cry ever in all my life. I've never seen my brother cry. That was the first time. And it came over me that maybe there's something to this. And the thought struck me. On the day of throwing the line, that thought troubled me. I left the church, and it seemed to start giving me a real, real battle. I don't know what was going on, but I just felt very uncomfortable. And for some reason, all of that pain that they were mentioning about the kind of things we would do when we were out to pray, I mean, it didn't want to go there. They were tantalizing to begin with, but they began to conflict with whatever was happening inside of me. And I didn't know what was happening inside of me. I just began to feel very, very, very troubled. And so, I was hoping to speak a lot and get out of New York City, but I felt like all this pressure was coming upon me. And I wanted to go to Europe. I wanted to do all these things. In fact, when I bumped by him, said, Louis, when we come back from Europe, we're not going to call it one. I want to introduce it to this, that, this, et cetera. And so, to me, I thought, man, what opportunities. And I did not want to, per se, to turn my back on that. But at the same time, I saw my brothers, and I could tell that there was something strange happening to them. I didn't know what it was. And as this struggle was going on, I was getting through. I got a telephone call telling me the tour had been postponed for 1 week. And I had been so corralled. And I thought I was going to have to face it. So when I got one time, I actually went to do a hotel. This is a hotel, the St. George Hotel, down in Brooklyn, New York. And I went there because I heard that there were 9 bands performing non-stop music. In other words, where we start, and I would pick up them and pick up from 9 o'clock before 5 in the morning. And since I love dancing, I decided I'm going to go and check it out and see if I can live without this. And that was a fear. The thought was, if I become a Christian, I'll have any fun. And maybe I might as well that way. I become a Christian, I'll have any fun. Number two, another thought was this. If you leave what you're doing, what are you going to do? The only thing I knew how to do was go and work at a machine shop. And that was a very humiliating thought because me and the Brits were the ones who came and did the lowly jobs. You know what I'm saying? And so here I am, playing with the world famous ball in the comments. And if I start doing that, I don't have any skills. I can barely read. What am I going to do? Go and work in a dingy dog factory and become nobody. Well, that was a humiliating thought to me. So I thought I was struggling with that. Well, but it's a struggle that I had to do it and see if I could live without it. I went to the dance. And when I got to the dance, the dancers in those days were called the monkey, the chicken, the wahoo. Any of you heard of those dances before? How many of you did those dances? Any of you? How many of you did those dances? So we got some monkeys in the audience, don't we? So I began to do the monkey, and I began to do the chicken, and the dog, and the bottle, and all those stuff. And I danced until midnight. So from 9 o'clock to midnight, I was dancing. How many hours is that? 3 hours. So I danced nonstop. Well, I get tired of going to the balcony, and I decided to look over the balcony just to see what other girl I could find. I always try to find a girl who really, really could dance. You know what I'm saying? So I'm looking around to see what other girl I could dance. But there are all these people popping up and down. Some like black monkeys, some like black chickens, some like dogs, and some like ducks. You understand what I'm saying? And the funny thing about it is that the hair in those days was the beehive. Any of you remember the beehive? I need to do something here and keep it up with me. I have to take the can and get the picture, okay? And all these people go for us behind the house down there, jumping up and down. And so, I'm not sure what all of this sudden, something strange happened. I'll never forget that. All of a sudden, what I used to consider cool became disgusting to me. I saw these people thinking that happiness came from acting like an animal. I've never seen that before. I heard this and I thought, this disgusting feeling. This is living. This is life. And then I struck with horror and thinking to myself, and I'm doing this. And then I said, look up to the ceiling. I said, Father, if you're there, please forgive what you've done for my brothers. I decided right there and then, enough. I'm not continuing that way. It didn't matter to me what would happen to me, what the outcome would be, whether I worked in a factory. It didn't matter to me. What mattered to me was this. I was not going to continue to be duped, deceived, or taken by this plastic lifestyle, because that's all I realized it was. That. It was only a plastic, make-believe lifestyle. People acting cool, except for just because other people were looking at them because they were acting cool. And then I thought, this is ridiculous, but we do it. And I said, Lord, if you're there, please forgive what you've done for my brothers. I left. And I remember telling the girl that night, I decided to become a Christian. She looked at me, shrugged my shoulders like, what is that? She had no idea what was happening inside this heart. Well, I got home trying to coming some horrible feeling to have. That is to feel lost. I had never felt lost before. Until that moment. And it's a horrible feeling. It's like looking into a terrible, dark thread. I began to shatter into thought. I was lost. I began to wrestle. It seemed like I came before my judgment, Lord. Because all the wretched things that I've done, all the gang fights, and all the people that I've hurt, and all the people that I mean, they were just all miserable, lousy things. And that was the problem. Came before me. And I recall beginning to ask God to help. I didn't know how to pray. But I wouldn't talk to pray. I just remember my mother, you know, with a rosary thing that beats in my life. So I was talking to God just like I'm standing there. I was saying, God, help me. And then it became intense. So intense that I fell on my knees in my ministry. When I fell on my knees, I felt something warm and warm coming down my face. I didn't know what it was. So I reached out to touch my face and find out what's going on. And I realized there were tears. I was crying. I haven't cried for years. It's like I've become callous, uncaring. It was like the storm was breaking forth. And then I said, God, take these tears from me. And when I said that, there's a peace that came over me, a peace that I've never before ever experienced. As I saw that peace, I felt as if though I was no longer smoking a drink or an abuser of substances. In fact, I stood up and I felt completely free from that stuff. I can say this to you in all honesty before God. I have never since that second, I have felt the desire for a drink or a smoke or a drug ever again. God, miraculously, took it away from me. mentor. They'll take cisterns. All this time I was trying to find completeness in meaning of life, in activities, in wealth, in popularity, in money, in possessions. But it didn't matter how much I had, it didn't matter how much I gained, it didn't matter what I accomplished, it didn't matter. No matter what I did, it was this awful, lacking sense that there was something missing. And it was up to that moment that I had no understanding. But from that moment on, it was clear to me that what I needed in my life was the Lord Jesus Christ. In fact, when I made that decision, the Lord did give me deliverance. The Lord did take it away from me. And praise God for his power, what he said. Praise God that God can bring fulfillment to a human life. And once I did that, I went to the barber shop and asked the barber to give me a haircut. I remember how joyful he was getting rid of a little hair. I go in and wash him and change my apparel. I got rid of all my clothes and gave it to the poor. I got rid of my equipment. That big equipment I had was sold for $20. I wanted to get rid of it. I took all my pictures, by the way. I don't have any pictures left because of the of tearing everything up. I wanted to wear it briefly. And then I called the province and I said, look, I'm on call with you. I quit. And why? What do you mean I quit? Sorry. Am I going? So if you go on the website, this particular website, Bill Haley and the Council of Sue, here's what they have about me. Lou Torres, Puerto Rican born musician who replaced Al Rapp on the bass guitar for a tour in late 67, early 68. Prior to working with Haley, Torres was a member of a group called Vampires, and others have been found to conclude around his time with the Council, Torres for a while. I have no idea what I found. But I had found religion. Religion never did anything for me. I found the one who can do something for me. And what is that? Jesus Christ. Our friends, listen. Listen to it. Young people who are in the church, I want you to hear me out. Some of you are listening to rock and roll music. And you're listening to these people, and you are made of your idols. And some of you are thinking in your minds that when you grow up, you're going to be like one of these idols. Great mistake. I can tell you, George Harrison from the Beatles, he not only died trying to find God. I can tell you, many of these people went out and became movie stars, famous, etc. Many of them longing to find God. They have died of dark, miserable deaths. Listen, Bill Haley, you want to know how Bill Haley died? You want to know? Bill Haley, I went to visit another soul. His only passed away. And he was on a fishing. So I couldn't talk to him. I wanted to talk to him about the Lord. And that's all he needed God in his life. But he wasn't there, so I talked to his wife, Martha. We chatted for a while, and I was late because I was doing a wedding in that town where he lived at that time. Bill Haley was a lonely individual. At nighttime, he wanted to talk to somebody. See, then what he would do, he would walk from his house to the police station at night. He didn't go by nighttime because he would be followed by people. You know, he always had to disguise himself, put a hat on, and sunglasses, and lots of people would recognize him. So they would harass him about him, you know, or your autograph, etc. He might not live a long life, but you know what I'm saying? And so, at nighttime, he would go on purpose just so he could talk to the police, so he could talk to somebody. Even though he was married, even though he had children, he had to talk to somebody. And one night, as he was walking to the police station, he had a heart attack and died. I remember the famous guy, Buck Wheat. I don't know how many of you ever heard of the Little Rascals. Have you heard of the Little Rascals? Have you heard of the Little Rascals? Buck Wheat was a little black fella. You remember him? Right? Buck Wheat used to come to my nightclub in New York City when I used to perform. And I can remember him show up, but you could still see him. He had this big brown hat that he would take down. And he would come in there with his black and white Jack. Jack was one of those wool jackets when they showed the passive stuff. You remember those scenarios? And he would come in also with a little handkerchief in his pocket. And he'd come in and say, hey, Buck, how are you doing? And we sit down together before I perform. And we'd chat and chat. And one of the things I noticed about Buck Buckley was this. He loved the reality of what he was doing presently. He wanted to somehow be transported back to when he was in show business and being in the limelight. He was not happy at all with his situation. He had no hope for the future. He never talked about anything in the future. He always talked about the past. And now when we began to perform, I had gone and said, we're going to go and play up here now. Get it? Then he would take another handkerchief from his pocket. He would turn around. All right. And then he would close his eyes and by himself, he'd just go around the circles and go around the circles and go around the circles. And then by himself the entire night. Then when it was time to go, he couldn't leave. He wanted to go. He had nothing to go to. He wanted to stay still dancing with his little handkerchief. And I remember thinking to myself, oh, I hope I never end up like this guy. That's the thought I had. He's famous, and that's where he ends up. And then Bill ends up the same way. And friends, I began to think, man, if that's the way you end up in show business, that's a horrible way to go. So, I discovered, my friends, young people, don't be deceived. You'll never find completeness in show business. You'll never find completeness in accomplishing something. The only one that can satisfy the longing of the heart is Jesus Christ. Who is it? But this morning, in conclusion, I'm going to give you the opportunity to respond. You've heard what God has done for me. And some of you may be having the same challenges. In your hearts, you might have thought, if I could only do this, if I could only get down, if I could accomplish this. There are Christians today who are thinking the same way. Thinking that life is about what you know. And friends, all you have to do is read the book of Ecclesiastes, the great preacher. And he concludes with this. All is what? Vanity. How about you? All is vanity. But a person does not have joy in this life. You end up drinking out of empty cisterns. If you think you can be satisfied, in the long run you'll find yourself thirsty. So today, if there's someone here who has not yet found fulfillment, but in your heart you recognize the Lord speaking to you, you might say, I want to try God. I wonder if you would lift up your hand right now and say, Lord, like him, do for me what you've done for him. Bring fulfillment to my life in you. Help me to turn to you and to know you. Anyone who wants to lift up their hand this morning and say, I can identify with that. I've been feeling empty. I understand what I need. I need to open up my heart to the Lord. Anyone like that? God bless you, young lady. Are there others? You recognize God speaking to you. Maybe you're not pursuing this, pursuing that. Maybe you're brought up in the church, but you have too much religion to be happy in the world, but not enough religion to be happy in the church. It's traveling. You haven't ever come to the place where you've known the woman as your friend and your Savior. Would you like to get off that fence? Say, Lord, I hear your voice. I open my heart to you. So, is there another one who would like to lift up their hand now? If you do so, great joy in our hearts and the hearts of those who are there. Is there someone here who also needs to make that decision? You have not been baptized, but you want to be baptized. Can you just bow your heads with me just a small